Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. All right. Well, I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Robin Hansen, who's an associate professor of economics at George Mason University, a research associate of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University, and the author of books such as The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life When Robots Rule the Earth, and The Elephant in the Brain, Hidden Motives in Everyday Life, with co-author Kevin Simler. So thanks, Robin, so much for being with me today.
It's great to be here. I look forward to our conversation.
Yeah, so I don't know if people will find this believable or not, but when I actually started to think about talking with you, I didn't realize you would be at the center of this huge controversy that had blown up. Although I don't feel like I'm at all kind of well versed in how that's played out, I feel like I would be remiss if we didn't talk about that for a minute. Could you kind of explain maybe what you said, and then kind of what it precipitated?
So I wrote a short, brief blog post written to my usual sort of audience in my usual style. And then I made a short, even briefer tweet based on that. Hmm. And it was apparently possible to read that tweet in a very negative light. And so many people took advantage of that to say outrageous responses there, as if, you know, I meant what they were accusing me of saying.
Yeah.
And so that created the usual for a firestorm, where many people want to show their loyalty to the side that they're on by showing their solidarity with the people on their side who are saying this other thing seems like a terrible thing. And so the actual tweet basically was very short. It said that some people have less sex than others, and they might be upset by that similarly and hurt by it, similarly to the way people are upset and hurt when they have less income. And we might feel empathetic toward them, and they might want to complain about it and lobby for help. And I call that help redistribution along that axis. Mm-hmm. And I meant, of course, redistribution literally means change the distribution, i.e., if there's inequality in sex and some people have less of it, we might want to find a way to change the distribution to get more of it. But I was accused of, you know, to their mind, obviously advocating rape and slavery, because of course I must mean redistribution in that form. Mm-hmm. Just like if we talk about income redistribution, surely we must mean like the French Revolution, where we're going to kill all the rich people, because mm-hmm. that would be the obvious thing we would do. I of course quickly tried to clarify, but that was not considered acceptable or sufficient, because merely if it was possible to misinterpret me, even intentionally, mm-hmm. then that was the crime of the moment, that people should say what a terrible person for being able to be misinterpreted.
Yeah. So there's a lot here, and to be clear, you weren't actually even advocating for doing this.
Right. I was just noticing this comparison, and mm-hmm. I finished the tweet, you know, saying it's interesting. There's a little overlap between the groups concerned mm-hmm. about income inequality and the people concerned about sex inequality. And I wasn't talking about men versus women. I wasn't advocating a change. I wasn't endorsing any particular kinds of ways to redistribute that you might think of. Quickly clarifying, I mentioned we have a lot of different ways you might change the distribution. That's obviously a complicated part of our life, so there'd be many potential policy levers. I was just noticing that some people might be interested in this, other people in the other, and that there's a interesting tension between those.
Yeah. So, this kind of goes to your work as an economist, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that you consider. And one person, I think, responded saying something like the creepiest professor in America or something like that.
That was a Slate article, actually.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so, so this is a highly, highly publicized.
And it continues. So just this morning, there was a New Yorker article, which again was very dismissive and negative, and you know, not accepting that sort of intellectual discussion thing, but just sort of throwing out negative words.
Yeah. And I think you responded to that Slate article by saying, actually, well, economics should be creepy, right? Something like that.
In some sense, yes, that is. So in that, creepiness is literally when somebody or something gives you this vague sense of unease, as if, even though it's not overtly a threat, you suspect it might actually be a threat.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and so that's what creepiness literally is. And of course, a creepy person could be someone who is just sending you the wrong vibes because, hey, they might actually be threatening, even though on the surface they're not actually threatening.
Right.
And we have all these intuitions about, like, the way things are supposed to be. And I think this topic, you know, violates a number of intuitions about the way things are supposed to be. That is, we have what I called in that post world norms, ways different parts of our lives should be separated and not connected or interact or compared. Yeah. And I think this topic brings up those because in many people's minds, sex and income are just two parts of two different worlds that should not be compared or connected. And by connecting these two, I'm violating that norm, and that seems vaguely threatening.
Yeah.
Even though they couldn't put their finger exactly on why it was threatening, it just seems like it's threatening. And that's the kind of thing economists should be doing sometimes. That is, we should be challenging these world norms and asking whether the various parts of our lives that we declare should be separate and disconnected, whether that's correct or not.
So there seems like there are two things to unpack there, one of which is... Were you performing an accurate analysis, okay, which is one thing. And then the other one is, should you have said this publicly? That kind of a question, right? And I feel like that what most people are saying is, I don't know about the whether you should have said this publicly. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, I think there are norms about how we're supposed to say things publicly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, usually my posts and my tweets are only ever read by other, you know, relatively intellectual nerd types. Mm-hmm. And so I was not intending to say something to the world. If I was been invited to give a speech in front of Congress or something, I'm sure I would have chosen my words and you know, differently. But it's part of this phenomenon that when intellectuals talk to each other, that is not in a separate private channel. Other people can listen in, and they can pick any one part of it and then take it to the world and say, look at this, isn't this terrible? So the question is, to what extent should intellectuals, when they're talking to each other, choose their words as if they were talking in front of Congress? Because it's possible that anything they might say might be taken and put in that larger world.
So I'm actually somewhat sympathetic to that kind of an argument that, well, you know, you might be right, but you shouldn't say this because it's, you know, it exists in this larger context and so forth. But I think the irony here is that I feel like the best person to, well, let me back up. I feel like the reason why you might say people should think differently about how they're talking than just trying to say what's intellectually true is that, language doesn't exist primarily just to convey intellectual ideas, right? It exists to do all these other things, serve all these other functions. And I actually think the irony of this is that I think that you're the one kind of best suited to make that case, because this is, as I'm reading it, this is the, well, I guess part of what I would take away from your book with Kevin Semler, The Elephant in the Brain, right? Which is that the things that we do don't always like kind of follow the what the obvious intentions we give them.
Sure. So let's stretch that out. Let's say, you know, often when we talk to each other in what seem to be abstract intellectual terms, what we're really doing is a number of other things. One of them is showing off, showing our capabilities and abilities. And our skills, our knowledge, our carefulness, our intellect. And another thing we're doing is we're showing loyalty. We are, you know, habitually agreeing with people on our side and giving other people reassurance and saying, yes, your boyfriend is terrible. Why does he treat you like that if you're complaining about him?
Yeah.
Right? We're giving people, you know, they're giving us cues about what kind of loyalty signals they want, and we're giving them cues back.
Yeah.
And one set of loyalty signals happens in this larger public conversation that is that whenever you bring up any sort of subject that has some controversy about it, many people, I think even most people, wants you to show that you're on their side before they're willing to think about the topic. So you need to show a signal. You know, if we're talking about Russia or something, you know, I can't just talk about Russia. I have to say, if I'm talking to the left, that I'm a good lefty. If I'm on the right, I'm a good right person. And I have to signal ahead of time which side I'm on. Right. And then you can see, oh, I'm on your side. And then you might be willing to listen to me. And if I don't signal that I'm on your side, you'll presume I'm on the other side or not on your side. And therefore, be habitually hostile and negative toward whatever it is that's said. And I think this is true. This is part of our larger political habits, is that people do tend to go out of their way to signal what side they're on. Mm-hmm. When they are talking about anything relatively central. Now, of course, this is a problem from the point of intellectual conversation, because it fragments the conversation.
Right.
You can't simultaneously signal to all the different sides.
Yeah.
And so you can't talk to everybody. You have to talk to each group separately. And of course, you may well not be fair in terms of, you might say different things to different groups.
Right.
And so I do think there is a place for an intellectual world where there's the norm that we don't follow that rule.
Mm-hmm.
Without we, in this intellectual world, we're trying to talk to everybody fairly and clearly, that in this world, we go out of our way not to do these value signals, as I call them,
mm-hmm.
not to go out of our way to show which side we're on an issue before we talk about it, where we just talk about the issue in direct and literal terms, and we don't expect these sort of value signals.
Yeah. So that kind of gets to, I think, a larger phenomenon, which we're seeing as a society, which is that social media has disrupted our normal approaches to engaging with each other, right? And so intellectual discourse has now, you know, now exists in a forum that you know, people sharing cat pictures also exists in, right? Like these things are in the same place, and we don't have norms that have caught up with this kind of reality. Right. And so we, you know, on Facebook or something like that, we're engaging in political discussions with our great grandmothers. And, you know,
I don't think it's Facebook. Social media is part of it. It's also just our increasing political polarization.
Hmm.
I think if social media had appeared a half century ago, we wouldn't be seeing this sort of reaction to it, because a half century ago in the United States, there was far less political polarization in the U.S., certainly.
So what do you think are the causes of that political polarization?
My explanation is relatively simple and straightforward and not terribly original. At the end of World War II, there were a whole bunch of parameters that were toward an extreme exactly because of the war.
Hmm.
One of them is income inequality. Just before World War I, income inequality and wealth inequality was near a peak, because for the previous century, it had been slowly increasing.
Yeah.
During peace times, and then during these war times, it was vastly reduced, because basically governments just grabbed the wealth of the rich because they could and needed and wanted to for the war. So at the end of the war, income inequality was very low, and it's been slowly increasing up since then, naturally, because, you know, in general, it does increase, except in the case of big disasters like wars and pandemics and civilization collapse. And similarly, about internal loyalty is similar. That is, at the end of World War II, U.S. was at a peak of internal allegiance and loyalty with respect to having just gone through a huge war against outsiders. So uniting against outsiders tends to unify people internally.
Yeah.
And the longer you go without an outsider that actually seems threatening, the less, you know, powerful that becomes, and the more you tend to focus on your internal divisions.
That's interesting.
And so plausibly, that's why we've slowly had this polarization over the last half century or so. And unfortunately, that doesn't give you great optimism for reducing it, because it says until we get another big outside enemy, aliens invading or something, we will continue to have increased polarization.
Yeah. So, that's very interesting. It goes to a lot of things. But so I want to talk about your books. You've been the creator of a lot of big ideas that I've been influenced by and have had a good time wrestling with. Let's talk about the elephant in the brain, though. Explain the premise of this. What is the elephant in the brain, and why is it there?
So this book, again, co-authored with Kevin Simler, is trying to say the one thing I think I've most learned in my career as a social scientist, related to the biggest mistake we've been making, which is to take people's motives at face value. So as social scientists, we tend to look at a subject like education or medicine or politics, and we hear people say why they're doing it, what their main motivation is. We usually just take that at face value. So people say they go to school to learn the material, they go to the doctor to get healthy, they vote in order to create better policy. Mm-hmm. And we accept those at face value and we work through more details and analysis of that. And then usually there's a whole bunch of puzzles, things that don't make much sense that we struggle with and try to make epicycle, you know, variations of the theories to explain. And I think, you know, a great way to make a lot more sense of these areas is to go back to that very first assumption and say, well, what if they're just wrong about why they're doing these things? Hmm. And it turns out you can make sense of a lot of behaviors that way. And this book is about that. So the first third of the book is why, in general, we might be wrong about why we do things, mm-hmm. why creatures might have evolved that way, and why that might be a plausible thing that could happen to humans. But to convince you you're wrong about many specific things, it's not enough to say that you could be wrong in general. We have to go through many specific things. So then we have 10 chapters on specific areas of life, saying that in each one, mm-hmm. there's a usual story about what you're doing and why, and here's a bunch of puzzles that don't make sense, and then here's a better theory that makes sense of these puzzles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so give an example or two of what would be a case where we're doing something for a reason we're not even aware of, or counter to
okay, so the degree to which we're aware of these things varies across people and across context. And so for many of these, many people are somewhat aware. And the sense in which they're not aware is that when they most speak in public, in the most sort of public forums, that's when they won't admit these as well. So for example, in public, in a graduation ceremony or in a letter of application, you would say you went to school to learn the material. But most people privately might admit they just want to get a job and they just need a credential. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in public, you might declare that your charity dollars are being given in order to help, while privately you might admit that you like the appearance of being someone who cares, who seems mm-hmm. to care. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, in politics, you might say in public that you want to vote to make produce better policy for the nation or the city or the world. Mm-hmm. And in private, you might admit that you really like to show your side, that you're with them, and that mm-hmm. that's an important motivation. Mm-hmm. And so these are some of the examples of the motivations we say. So most of the motivations that we'll offer as the real motivations won't be terribly surprising. Mm-hmm. There'll be something most of you had already considered as something that happens sometimes to mm-hmm. other people, mm-hmm. especially to your hypocritical rivals,
right?
who you tend to be better able to notice their mm-hmm. deviations from what they say and what they really are doing. Right. But for yourself and your allies, you tend to give a benefit of the doubt that what you say is really what's going on.
Yeah. So it was interesting to me in reading through some of the stuff. You make biblical allusions, and and I think they're interesting. So the one that was brought out was I think in Matthew, where Jesus says, you know, take the log out of your own eye, and then you can take the speck out of somebody else's eye. So that kind of goes to what you're saying. Like, we can see the hypocrisy in somebody else, but we have a much harder time looking at the hypocrisy in ourselves.
Right. And so, in fact, one question that has come up, you know, in the context of the book is people ask me, well, what about your motives, Robin? And yeah. why are you doing this? Yeah. And how well can you see your motives? And then how well can anybody using this book see their own motives? And is that something they should be trying to do? And how well could this help them?
Yeah.
And honestly, I have to say, we all probably have a limited budget for honesty. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do. And you know, you'll get more resistance looking at yourself for your own honesty, because there's a lot more parts inside you that will try to oppose that. Mm-hmm. And so the simplest strategy, I think, is just to try to make sense of the world of other people out there far away from you. Mm-hmm. And try to guess what's roughly going on for them, their typical motives for typical behaviors. And then when you need to make an assumption about yourself, just assume you're like everybody else.
So
now, maybe yeah. you're not, but mm-hmm. you know, you don't really have necessarily usually strong reasons to think you're that different from everybody else. Mm-hmm. You'd have strong reasons to want to think you're different from other people. But for most people, most of the time, they really aren't going to be that different from everybody mm-hmm. else. So mm-hmm. just suck it. Just accept it. You're probably like most everybody else.
Yeah. So just look at all the backstabbing kind of hypocritical people out there and assume that's probably what you're
well,
like.
If that's what most people out there are like, mm-hmm. then that might be what you're like. If it's only what 10% of the people are out like, mm-hmm. they're like, then maybe not you. But yeah. if it's 80% of the people are out there a certain way, you're probably that way too.
Yeah. So talk about why this would exist, because I mean, I think the argument that you anticipate is that why don't we just know things, right? Like, why is it an advantage?
Why not just admit these things? So for most of these motives, they're not crazy motives to have.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are even somewhat laudatory. Like we say, you know, the main motive in medicine is to show you care about people and to let other people show they care about you, which seems like a nice thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So the key story here is that human brain was large in order to deal with the complicated social world around us. And the unique feature of the human social world compared to other animals was norms. So a norm is a rule about what you're supposed to do or not supposed to do. And humans use language and weapons to enforce norms.
Mm-hmm.
And that means a big part of a human social world is watching out for people around you, whether they're violating norms, and asking yourself, could you call them on it and should you? And of course, watching out for whether other people could accuse you of norm violations and trying to protect yourself against that. And so that means when you're looking at yourself, wondering why, what your motives are, this conscious part of your mind that's actually, you know, able to talk to other people and explain itself well, more plausibly, its function isn't to actually know why you do things. Its function is to be able to explain yourself.
Mm.
If it's the press secretary, it's not the king or the president.
Mm-hmm.
And so its job is to look at what you're doing and always have a good story about your motives.
Mm.
So that you could avoid norms, which are often expressed in terms of motives. So there's the norm that you're not supposed to hit people on purpose. It's okay to hit people accidentally.
Mm.
And so if you hit somebody, you'll need to have a good story that you didn't mean to, and to make that plausible.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we are just unaware of our motives, is because it's more important for our conscious minds to have a good story to explain our motives should somebody challenge us than it is for our conscious mind to know our actual motives.
That illustration of the press secretary makes a lot of sense, right? You if you're the president, you don't tell the press secretary everything. They're supposed to know the stuff that makes you look good, and that's pretty much it, right?
And now they're supposed to sound like they know,
right? Yeah,
but and they can honestly give their best picture if you don't tell them the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, if you can guess that they will make up a reasonable sounding story that sounds good, and you know that the truth isn't that pretty, if you tell them, it'll make it harder for them to do their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you don't tell them and they don't ask.
So we're the press secretaries of our own minds, and we're let in on a need to know basis to what's really going on, something like that.
Right. Now, of course, we have to make it a plausible story. And so that means we can't go too far away from what the evidence would suggest. And so that means if the evidence seems pretty clearly to suggest negative motives, what we're going to kind of have to own up for that. And so we're on the edge of looking for what story we can spin plausibly that would make sense and that the audience might believe.
So the there's some examples in the book, and I think this is really counterintuitive to people, but where it talks about kind of the danger or of having options, or the advantage of not knowing, or things like that. So I think one example you used was like playing chicken, right, with another car.
Sure.
And the argument was the best strategy is to remove your steering wheel, throw it out the window. So explain why the lack of options, or you know, something like that, actually might be an advantage.
So that's the advantage of commitment, although that's not really very central to our book. So our book is mostly about just merely the fact that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's helpful that you commit to not knowing, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, that's not a very big part of the analysis. Commitment, it is an important part of game theory to understand when and where you want to commit to things. But a commitment is also pretty expensive and dangerous, as that illustration will give you. If both of them throw their steering wheels out the window before they notice the other guy does, then it's a pretty bad outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be careful about commitment.
Mm-hmm.
I think something closer to the center of the book, though, is the observation that these people around us who are watching out for norm violations, they're doing that because of a norm that they should point out norm violations, but they don't really want to.
Mm.
They're not trying very hard. And that's what makes it more understandable that we can get away with a lot of these pretty transparent kinds of hypocrisy.
Hmm.
So an example we use is drinking alcohol in public out of a paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you have a bottle inside a paper bag. Now, the only time pretty much anybody ever does that is when they're trying to hide the fact they're drinking alcohol in public. So it's not like it fools anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But police and others who don't really want to enforce this rule feel that they must if you really blatantly wave around a bottle of alcohol in public as you drink it, because there's a rule you're not supposed to be drinking in public. But they have other things to do, and they don't really think it's that important. Mm-hmm. So if you give them any mild excuse, like the paper bag, they will just be happy to ignore it. And so this is why a lot of these hypocrisies we have about our motives are pretty transparent often. And you might wonder, well, how is it that we get away with fooling anybody? Because it isn't so obvious. But the key point is, you're not really fooling people. You're just giving them a good enough excuse to look the other way.
And why does that make sense again? You're saying because they're not actually incentivized to enforce it in this
right.
case?
The rule is, you know, if you violate a rule, then somebody else who sees you violating a rule, the rule on them is they're supposed to do something about it. Mm. If you see someone violating a rule, you don't do somebody. Now, something, you violated a rule.
Yeah.
And so they're just wondering, well, who else could see whether I saw somebody violate a rule, right. whether I did something, right?
Right.
And so just like you might violate a rule, if you look around and notice nobody's going to see you, so you might violate, like jaywalking, say. Mm-hmm. You'll look both ways to see if you can get away with jaywalking and then just jaywalk. Mm-hmm. And somebody else who might think they're supposed to call on you for jaywalking, and they could just keep looking the other way and look in the store window and pretend they didn't see you, because mm-hmm. they don't really want to have to do something about it.
Right.
And so that's why a lot of these hidden motives are a lot less hidden
right.
than you might think they'd have to be. A lot of most people know about them mm-hmm. and are pretty aware in most even specific cases. And nevertheless, we still go through these motions of pretending we don't see.
This makes me think of, I'm trying to think if it is an example of this at all, but like meeting, like if you're in the store and you see somebody you know, but you don't want to talk to, and so you look the other way, and they
exactly.
look the other way, and you both know you're there, but as long as you don't like make
right, exactly.
eye contact, you don't have
see,
to acknowledge it.
The norm is if you notice somebody you know at the store, you're supposed to say hi. It would be
right.
rude not to. But
right.
you don't really want to notice them.
Right.
You don't really want to talk to them. So you just pretend not to notice them. And they might pretend not to notice you. And you might both be aware that you're pretending not to notice each other. But as long as a third party
right.
couldn't say, I noticed those people, I saw those people ignore each other
yeah.
on purpose,
yeah.
then you're safe from the enforcement of the norm.
Yeah. It's so fascinating. We have these like really recursive behaviors. And we do. And I think you talk about this that happens in preaching and so forth, where it's the attempt to establish a common knowledge, which is not just that I've told you
right.
this, but
Absolutely.
We've all heard this being told, right? What's at play there? What's the stakes, or why is that important?
Well, if you're trying to change the rules or establish rules, it's not enough to tell any one person the rule. You have to show each person that everybody else has heard the rule, and mm-hmm. everybody else has heard that everybody else has heard the rule, so that now you know that's the rule.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, as you say, that's part of the function of sermons.
Yeah.
You could each read the section of the Bible or the section of the sermon separately.
Mm-hmm.
But if you all come together and listen to the sermon, not only do you know that everybody else heard it, you would know that everybody else nodded and agreed and said amen.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. that they accepted it, and even enthusiastically
yeah.
the message here, and so that you know what together you are accepting.
Yeah. Well, that one of the things that I kept thinking about is because one of the things you point out is that, you know, we have these religious behaviors. They often have these hidden motivations as well. But there is something, it really reminded me of the Christian concept that we have this kind of fallen nature, right? We're trying to make good
sure.
decisions, all this, but in fact, something
right.
else is making decisions
sure,
through
absolutely.
Our good intentions. And
sure.
so, yeah, you're making a case for something like that in a sense, right?
Well, I mean, certainly these hidden motives, they are usually lower motives. They are less respectable
mm-hmm.
motives, and they are certainly closer to sin.
Mm-hmm.
That is
mm-hmm.
most, you know, the motives that we would most like to call the public, they tend to be less the ones that would violate a sin rule. That,
yeah.
that is, they are not sins.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so certainly a big part of trying to appear like you're not sinning
mm-hmm.
is to try to be able to have positive explanations for your behavior that aren't attributable to sins.
Right.
And, you know, sin is just this, you can think more generally, this category of the things you're not supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Norm violations.
Yeah, so you another thing you talk about is the fact that we can know with different parts of our mind essentially what what maybe the truth is, and then what we're kind of believing over here, something like that. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Sure, our minds are complicated,
mm-hmm.
and they have different parts, and so our conscious minds leak a lot, and
mm-hmm.
so it turns out for us to be actually difficult for us to consciously lie. I mean, there are people who are good at it and there are actors, but they're rare. Mm-hmm. For most of us, if we have a conscious thought in one direction, then we try to pretend as if we have something different, it will just leak out in many different ways. And people are good at noticing those leaks and they can tell. Mm-hmm. So in order to actually be hypocritical effectively, we kind of have to let our subconscious handle the actual, you know, choices that are made and let our conscious mind think otherwise. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, why, and it's a big part of actually law and tradition that people who do things and consciously lie are held to higher standards. They're lower standards. They're given less punishment, more punishment than people who are unconsciously lying. If you are, you know, not intending consciously to do something and you do harm, like you kill somebody, but it's a crime of passion and you didn't consciously intend to kill them, then that's a lower punishment than a premeditated murder where you made a conscious plan.
Yeah, so interesting. So one of the things that you posed, and I didn't see the answer to it, but you posed the question, I think, early on in the book, is anyone really a creationist? And so what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think as with this recent political event, there are beliefs that we have that in our minds we associate with our group identity, that they're importantly part of being part of a group. Mm-hmm. And they're usually beliefs that don't actually affect our personal actions that much. Mm-hmm. Yet they're beliefs that are important for the group. And so with those beliefs, we hold them to a somewhat different evidentiary and analysis standard. Mm-hmm. We are not as careful with them. We're not as precise about them. Mm-hmm. We just more habitually endorse them and get emotional about it and get mad at people who might oppose it. Mm-hmm. And we're not really very careful about what exactly they mean. And we're often flummoxed if somebody were to ask us to define them. Mm. Nevertheless, we use sort of rough associations to figure out who's for or against them. And then we are very definite about those things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's part of ideology and religion going back forever, mm-hmm. is that, we use these beliefs. Now, I mean, it's not that we don't believe them. That is, in some sense, the willingness to put yourself in a state of mind where you believe you believe them is part of the signal you are sending of loyalty to your side. That is, it's an expensive signal. That is, if you only mouthed the words and didn't actually at some level believe them, then that would be less of a cost you're paying. Mm. The fact that you at some level emotionally and mentally sound like you believe them, mm-hmm. Is a reason to think you're on your side. Although, you know, there are definitely extremes. So many, it's like traditional beliefs of religion and ideologies, like they do cost. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to those, then people often like start to react differently. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so if your belief about being a patriot or religious loyalty meant that you should go fight a war and be on one side of a war, well, then from a distance, you might think, yes, that's true, as long as there isn't actually a war that you might get put into. Mm-hmm. And even from a distance, but you're not actually in a battle, you might still be rah-rah about it. But the closer you get to like actual conflict where something might really happen, then your beliefs start to change.
Yeah.
And you know, it becomes much more of a test of how dedicated you are, whether you will go through these things. And of course, many people have noticed that people have a lot of beliefs, you know, lightly held from a distance when the consequences aren't very large. Mm-hmm. And when things get large, then we see more of a test. That's certainly part of the Bible tradition, of course. Mm. I mean, and, you know, I believe Jesus mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, the difference between people who hold beliefs lightly when there's not much at stake, and then the people who actually in the hour of need, you know, came through.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that gets to some things you've said about, you know, what kinds of opinions you should hold and things like that. But it also gets to this other question, which I hope you don't mind me asking, which is your relationship with religion. Because I saw that you talked about your father. You grew up, like I did, as a preacher's kid. And you described your father as a preacher and programmer, I think.
Right.
So that's an interesting combination. That's an unusual one. How did that work out?
Well, I mean, actually, my father was a pastor for many years, and even right when he died, he was a pastor. Mm-hmm. My mother writes Christian tween novels. The two of them together were missionaries to Australia when I was 1 year old and took me with them.
Wow.
One of my brothers is a pastor of his own small church. Another one is the head of the music at the church where my dad was a pastor. So I have a pretty religious family going mm-hmm. a long way back. And, you know, I early on sort of drifted away from religious beliefs in the sense of I was learning physics in college, and I became a very, you know, fundamentalist physicist, if you will. Mm-hmm. Physics explains the whole world, and there's not much room for anything else. And so yeah. there wasn't much room for mysticism or supernatural things in that worldview. Mm-hmm. But I, compared to other people, like, are upset when they change their mind there and they go, like, go complain with their parents, why did you teach me this thing that's all wrong? And that was never my inclination.
Yeah.
And as I've become a social scientist, of course, you know, there's the question, well, what's going on with religion? And as we have this chapter in the book, you know, I think anyone should admit that at least at the individual level, religion does great for people. Mm-hmm. Individuals do very well by religion. Mm-hmm. People who are more religious, the correlations are strong. They're healthier. They earn more money. Their marriages last longer. There's less crime. There's less drugs. There's, you know, more friends. Mm-hmm. Just everything goes better mm-hmm. for more religious people. And so, you know, that has to factor into your overall attitude toward religion mm-hmm. and also your explanation for why religion mm-hmm. is there. So, you know, so many people who become atheists have the simple model of the world, which is, well, long ago people were stupid and didn't think about things very carefully. Mm-hmm. And they were fooled by these, you know, clever priests and prophets who tricked them into these silly beliefs because they didn't have science or reason to figure things out. And now that we have science and reason, of course, if you're a reasonably intelligent person, you can figure out that all that's completely wrong and you can just drop it. But unfortunately, so many people are conservative, or they're resistant to reason, or they're just mm-hmm. Loyal to their group, and they won't listen to these reasonable arguments that say that religion's all wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's a common explanation many people offer.
Yeah.
And I just think that doesn't work. That's not a very good explanation yeah. for the phenomenon of religion in the world.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there's a lot of people who maybe dismiss religion as kind of a naive science, right? Like it tried to explain sure. the world, and then it didn't do a very good job, something like that. So what's your account of religion given that?
Well, I would say religion seems to have clear social functions. And part of that social function is mediated by a certain kind of belief, which is not held in the same sort of seriousness or analytic sort of style mm-hmm. as other sorts of beliefs might be held, but it still functions importantly in their lives. Mm-hmm. So religion most fundamentally functions to help people show allegiance to a group. Mm. Religious people are devoting themselves to each other. They are paying costs. They are, you know, spending in rituals and self-sacrifice and time and devotion to yeah. show each other that they are devoted to each other. Yeah. And that succeeds. They are, in fact, more devoted. Religions that demand more of people are, in fact, religions where people can rely on each other more, and they do rely on each other more. And that's a benefit. Mm-hmm. It's a real benefit. And, you know, you can have religions where there are no beliefs. It's just about practices of showing loyalty. And religions like that have existed in the past. But mm-hmm. the modern religions, apparently there's an extra advantage from having these beliefs.
Yeah.
And again, most of these beliefs are not very connected with actions you would take on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. They're more in the abstract ideology realm of abstract cosmology or ideas about things, mm-hmm. such that, you know, having those beliefs shows your loyalty to the group. And so from a functional point of view, you might think, well, so it isn't true, but it isn't true in a way that doesn't matter. So why shouldn't I embrace it and believe it in order to show loyalty to my group, to be a member of the group? Mm-hmm. And so I think that is roughly right. That is, we have this one drop of pollution, like, kills everything sort of model. That is, if you ever allow a false belief into your head, you're lost and everything's gone, because now you could be, you know, drawn to conclude any crazy belief. But of course, that's just not true. Mm-hmm. We have ways of separating things out and to allow ourselves to believe things that are not that well grounded, perhaps, but or supported, but still somewhat insulated from the other things that matter more. And we do that a lot. We are good at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. We actually talked at the Mormon Transhumanist Conference, I think a year ago or so. One of the things that you talked about that was brought up in conversation was your idea about basically which opinions we should take, right? Like which opinions we should hold. And it kind of goes to this, right? That I think you were arguing that we should not just kind of have opinions about everything. We should have opinions about things we are invested in. Is that a fair account?
So I made a case like that in my recent excuse me, interview with Sam Harris.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even if you're not focused on signaling your loyalty to groups by making sure you have beliefs that fit with their loyalty signals, if you're just being practical with your beliefs, you still probably should just not be so promiscuous with your beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't. Many people seem to have this norm that if any topic comes up that's a topic that other people discuss, they should just have an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems wrong.
So why is that wrong? What's so dangerous about that?
Well, I mean, the literal sense is that if you pick a belief without considering it much, mm-hmm. it's likely to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll have knock-on effects on all the things you use it for. A more refined sense could be, well, in an intellectual world, we should have a division of labor where we each specialize in a topic.
Mm-hmm.
And we, on the topics we specialize in, then we offer to the rest of the world our extra contribution there, the mm-hmm. things that they might not realize because they haven't focused on them.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the other topics, the vast majority, we should accept the contributions of other people. We should say, okay, you've looked at this more than I have, and I'm just going to go with what you've got. Tentatively, because, hey, that's not my specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And a division of labor is how we do most everything in the economy. You know, you don't make your own shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even, you know, repair your own cars, mm-hmm. usually. You have a division of labor, and that's great. And you should do that intellectually well. And, of course, if there's a topic where if it doesn't have much consequence, you might think, well, why should I even bother to focus on it? Because it hardly matters. So you should ask for any one topic first. Doesn't matter enough for me to even think about whether to have any opinion. And secondly, is if it matters, should I be the one to focus on it, or should I rely on somebody else's contribution?
So is this an argument for deferring to experts in a general sense?
Well, deferring to whoever you best guess would know. So sometimes the word experts comes with connotations.
Mm-hmm.
If expert just means whoever knows best, then yes, of course. But
sometimes
experts mean somebody who has a PhD or somebody who would be cited in the newspaper, et cetera. And now we're talking about credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And you could reasonably have a belief that the credentialed people aren't the people who know best.
Mm.
There are many areas where that's a plausible conclusion.
Mm-hmm. So is that something you would do on try to figure out on a case-by-case basis? Or is that something you have an opinion about across the board?
Well, you're going to have to generate some broad heuristics, and you can't be that certain about them.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, there's no escaping that. Mm-hmm. If you're going to defer to other people, you have to decide who else to defer to.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure I'm using a complicated intersecting set of heuristics. But one is like, who actually just directly has data on something?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if I'm going to like learn how to ski, I might like go to somebody who seems to be able to ski.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody who wrote an academic paper on skiing. For the particular academic part of that paper, I might believe that, but that I won't necessarily believe that will tell me how to ski.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so if somebody is really good at, say, investing and they've made a lot of money, they still might not have published an academic paper on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I might say, well, look, they're good at this. Now, of course, when people tell you something, you have to wonder how close is the thing they're telling you to the thing they're good at?
Mm.
Because, of course, often somebody who's good at investing might be good at convincing somebody else to invest with them, which is not necessarily those other people's interest.
Right.
So just because they've been good at getting other people to pay the money to invest doesn't mean their advice with me is good. It means that they are benefiting from their situation. So, mm-hmm. again, you have to think these things through.
Yeah. Talking about the conference we were at last year, what you were speaking on then was your book, The Age of M. Explain what the the basic idea of that book is. Because when I first heard it, the title, I thought it was maybe like a fantasy series, something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's a problem with a short title. But there's a long subtitle, which is Work, Love, and Life When Robots Rule the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So that the main thing you need to know is that M is a certain kind of robot. So short for emulation.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the robots that you've seen so far are based on people writing software,
mm-hmm.
sitting in front of their computers, typing in code, or perhaps fitting a statistical model with parameters that will then, you know, fit in some parameterized behavior model. That's how people have been making robots so far. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, exciting recent progress on that. But progress is slow, and plausibly at past rates of progress, it'll still take several centuries till we can make mm-hmm. robots that are as good as people on the typical task. But there's another scenario by which we might get smart robots. And this is analogous to porting software. So today, if you have some old computer running software you like, and you want software like that running on a new computer, one approach is to stare at the old software, try to guess how it works, and then write new software that works how you think the old software works, mm-hmm. which is hard and expensive if the software is large and complicated. But another approach is to write what's called an emulator on the new machine that just makes the new machine look like the old one to the software. Mm-hmm. You can write an emulator, you just move the software over, you don't have to understand it. It just works. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to do that for the brain. Mm-hmm. To write an emulator for the software that's in the human brain. So to do that, we're going to have to scan individual human brains at fine spatial and chemical detail to see what cells are where, connected to what or what type. And then we're going to have models of how each cell works in terms of taking signals in, changing state, sending signals out. And mm-hmm. when you have good enough models for all the cells and in a good enough scan of all the cells in a brain, then you can make a overall model of that particular brain. Mm-hmm. And it, again, if the scan is good enough and the models are good enough, then the whole model should be good enough. It should have the same input-output behavior. Mm-hmm. You hook it up with artificial eyes, ears, hand, mouth, send signals in, and then it would act and respond in the same way the original person would in the same situation. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's a tall order, but if you can make it, mm-hmm. you know, then you have this powerful machine that can replace people. So mm-hmm. this is an old subject that's come up a lot over the many decades. And when it does, people usually focus on philosophy or technology. They talk about, when could it happen? Is it even possible? If you made one, is that conscious? Would you make one of you? Is that you or somebody else? And so I've thought those are all fascinating questions, but people have neglected the key question of what would actually happen. So I decided to write a book on what would actually happen, to set mm-hmm. aside all those generic philosophy concerns about which scores of books length of material have been written, and say, but what would happen? And people hadn't done that before. And that seemed to be the sort of thing I could do. Mm-hmm. And so my book is a long, detailed treatment. And in part, it's to show that it's possible to answer a question like that. So many people have this presumption that if I assume a particular technology like that, and then I ask, how does the world change? That's just not something anybody knows how to do. It's just fundamentally uncertain. Because most of the people who think that way are people who are technologists. They like me, when I was a physics student or a computer science student, they were basically told those other people over there in social science building, they don't know anything. They're making it up. And so people are then taught to think that whatever social intuitions they have in their head are about the best anybody could do, and therefore nobody could know about what would happen in a scenario like this. And I think that's just wrong. We do know a lot, and I used this occasion to try to show just how much you could say about a concrete scenario.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right in saying, okay, so what would happen rather than all the kind of philosophical questions that most people want to ask, right? Which is like, what does this mean and all that kind of stuff. You're just saying, how would this play out? How would society change? And what are the kind of big bullet points of that? Like, what does change? What happens?
So it's a huge change, and part of the interesting feature of the change is it violates many of our assumptions about how the future should go. So over the last few centuries, people have been getting rich. Mm-hmm. And as we get rich, our behavior has been changing in certain consistent directions. And many people like to imagine futures where that continues. Mm-hmm. So Star Trek future or culture novel futures where our descendants are even richer than we are, even have even more leisure, they're even more liberal, they're even more aghast at slavery and have more democracy, and that they don't even eat meat anymore because they're so, you know, moral. Mm-hmm. And that's a trend that people have rejected. And of course, they also have less religion because that's also been a trend.
Right.
And this world I describe is not such a world. Mm-hmm. In this world, these robots, because their population can expand so quickly, even faster than their economy expands, then the population expands until wages fall to subsistence levels. Mm-hmm. So we go back to what the usual case in human and animal history, which is subsistence wages. And so these robots are, you know, competitive. They have to work most of the time to survive. Mm-hmm. And they're very productive. That is, out of the 7 billion humans or more, only a few hundred of those, the very best humans, are copied a lot. So most M's are copies of the few hundred most productive humans. So there's this huge selection effect. So the typical M is really elite compared to the typical human. They're like a billionaire, a Nobel Prize winner, or something like that. Hmm. But they're still competing strongly because it's so easy. It's easy for any one M to take over any one profession mm-hmm. by making many copies of themselves. And these M's can also run at different speeds. And so I guess actually they run typically at 1,000 times human speed. Mm-hmm. And the economy speeds up less than 1,000 times, although much faster. So our current economy doubles every 15 years. And I'm guessing their economy doubles every month. And so as much change as has happened in our entire industrial era would happen in a year or two for them. And so this entire age of M is something I'm only estimating lasting a year or two, after which something else happens. And I don't say what. But still, during that time, there's this enormous change. The biological humans are on the margins. They start out owning most of the capital, but they have to retire because they can't compete at the office. And, you know, on average, they get rich really fast because as the economy doubles every month, their wealth doubles every month. But still, they have a problem if some of them don't own any wealth. It doesn't, doubling zero doesn't get you anywhere. And so there's issues of charity and redistribution among the humans. But mostly, they are marginalized and become less relevant. That is, just like today, we still have foragers out there in the woods, but there's a small number of them, and they really don't have much prospect of influencing the world. And then that's what the biological humans become like.
So, okay, so that's interesting, because you're saying that there, for some biological humans, they have a lot of wealth and it increases very rapidly, but that's almost irrelevant, in a sense, to what's actually going on. This kind of population explosion of robots.
So those rich capitalists, those rich humans are the capitalists of this world. Their wealth stays a lot as a proportion, but still declines as a proportion. And of course, there's always the risk of revolution or theft, such that it would decline faster. And it's hard to guarantee against that. But they are still less relevant. Just like in the past, you know, during the Industrial Revolution, people who were landed gentry, who owned a lot of land and wealth because of that, still, if they didn't invest in the industrial economy, they declined as a fraction of the economy, just sitting on their land.
So what your scenario is basically that someone invents the ability to scan a human brain, put it in a robot, and then within a couple of years tops, the economy has basically exploded to being billions of these kinds of duplicates.
Right.
Who are all working as hard as they can for subsistence wages, who are mostly clones of each other, which are in turn clones of the most successful humans. And basically biological humans become very irrelevant and they maybe have their own kind of struggles going on over here. But the real thing that happens is this short period of time in which this explosion happens, and then something else happens after that. We don't know what, or at least you haven't told us what yet.
Right. So I think, you know, you should think about change in terms of doubling of the economy. That is, the more doublings you're trying to see through, the harder it is to see farther. And when growth is faster, that means it'll be a shorter period of time before that horizon of difficulty of seeing makes it too hard to talk.
Yeah.
So I do have some interesting guesses about what might happen after the Age of M, but the Age of M is focused on just that period.
Okay. So I want to hear your interesting guesses, and maybe it goes into this question, which is like that the Age of M sounds like a pretty grim future. And
I don't think it is for the typical element residents. Okay.
Okay.
No, of course, this is related. I think most people in the farming era who were subsistence farmers, their lives were okay, too. I think people go too far in saying that our ancestors were living hell until recently. I mean, it is nice to be rich. There's no question that you have a choice. Being rich has advantages. But I don't think it's fair to think that the typical human all through history was just in a living hell. And only now have any lives ever become worth living. I mean, there certainly have been bad times. There have been pandemics and wars and bad things have happened. But for most people in history, most of their days of their life were okay days. And I think in this future world, that will still be true. These subsistence M's, they are having okay lives. They are selected for being good at their jobs, which is in part for being passionate and happy with doing their jobs. And also, they mostly live and work in virtual reality where they never need pain or hunger, grime, disease. Their bodies are always beautiful. So there's a lot of advantages in this world, not to be neglected. And of course, they're in a large economy which can afford to spend even more than ours does on making great stories and music and art and decorations. Mm-hmm. And so their environments they're in are always luxuriously beautiful, far more beautiful than most any environments we ever see in our world, just because they have such a much larger economy that can afford to create beauty, and it's so easy to do in virtual reality to implement it. They have a beautiful world. They are beautiful. They're comfortable, but they're working most of the time at jobs they really like, they're passionate about, even workaholic about, but nevertheless, working most of the time.
Okay. Yeah. So that, yeah, that's interesting. So it does sound, it sounds like what many kind of dystopian stories try to portray, which is a future that seems good in some respect, but doesn't have a lot of freedom, right? Like there's some kind of, or not a lot of options maybe.
Many dystopian novels imagine some government restriction on freedom, some oppressive government. Mm-hmm. And of course, fewer of them imagine just being poor, which of course is a restriction on your freedom in a sense. Obviously, when you're rich, you have more freedoms, but it's a different kind of restriction. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly that they are choosing it. That is, for each of these lineages, you could choose to have a small number of copies and each of those copies could be rich, or you could choose to make a lot of copies if each of humans poor. And most of the M's are from the lineages that chose to make a lot of copies. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
so many, in some senses, they're choosing this world.
Yeah. So
you could still disapprove, think it's a terrible world, but acknowledge that they've chosen this world and they kind of like it.
Yeah. So that's interesting. The question, which is maybe a category error here, but it goes to what should we do about this, right? What should we try to stop this? Should we accept it? Or does the what maybe comes next change something about how we think about this?
Well, sure. Now, I think actually, if we're going to think about hidden motives, most of the time when people are talking about the future, they're not actually very interested in the real future. Mm-hmm. They're mostly using the future as a way to reaffirm values that they have now and in the world they have around them. So there's this old trope about science fiction. It's mostly an indirect way of talking about the world around you. And that's roughly right.
Yeah.
And I think most like futurist discussions and even science fiction things, they are focused on scenarios where it's easier to talk values because that's what people really want to do. They really want to basically talk values. Mm-hmm. But the real world is really complicated. And in a realistically complicated world, it's much harder to figure out what your values imply because everything's so complicated. A great example, I think, is just to ask, going back 1,000 years, 1,000 AD, imagine you could describe to someone then roughly the outlines of the industrial world, what would roughly happen over the next 1,000 years, and then ask them, what should they do about it? Now you have all the benefit of hindsight, knowing about how it's all played out roughly, and you'll still be pretty, stumped to know what in particular somebody 1,000 years should have done. Mm-hmm. The basic fact is very few people can control the world, to influence the world as a whole. Most of our choices are influencing the world around us, the friends we have, the jobs we have, and our homes and our families. And even to try to influence the world as a whole is very hard to do. And even if you can do it, you mostly want to project onto some simplicity moral story axis in order to be able to do it. So most of the stories that engage us, say Star Wars or other sorts of science fiction stories, mostly they make a moral drama there such that it's relatively easy to figure out which side you should be on. And then you can feel really good about feeling that you're on the right side there. Mm-hmm. But they greatly oversimplify what realistic choices would be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's it always strikes me that great moral dramas are easy to look back on and decide which side we should be on, right? Something like that we should have been on.
Right.
But by definition, when you're in them, it's not easy to figure that out. And so that makes sense. Like in the real future, the actual dilemmas will be so difficult for whoever's there that they won't make good Star Trek episodes for example.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even at like say the beginning of World War II, trying to decide which side to be on, I mean, you might think you could roughly do that, but asking somebody in 1000 AD to anticipate that and figure out what side they should be on, that's just a much harder thing. So I can roughly give you an outline of this world, and I think you can think about some things you might favor or not, and some levers you could do about it, but it will not be at the usual scale of a grand cosmic soap opera. How you're saving everybody from everything.
Right.
It'll be much more minor modifications that push in a good direction.
Yeah. So what are your wild speculations about what comes after the Age of M? What happens next?
So M's are a scenario where a certain kind of software copied from human brains becomes feasible. And the key assumption is that happens before we know how to automate everything through the other kind of software. Mm-hmm. But one key question, though, is if we keep improving other kinds of software during the Age of M, might we eventually reach a point where other kinds of software outcompete M's on everything? Mm-hmm. You know, even if they might have outcompeted humans earlier, but still now they're competing with M's, who are more capable and cheaper. But still, and now this is a question of software. So they both have the same access to the same kind of hardware. Mm-hmm. But is there an advantage that the artificial software has over the human mot brain software? That becomes a key question for this next era. So if the artificial software just beats out humans, the M's, then basically we reach this point where all the M's are unemployed, just like the humans were before. And now they all own fractions of the wealth in this new set of robots. And then, of course, there's the key question, well, what is happening in this new software? And might it have agency and preferences, et cetera, which make it hard for these outside owner managers to keep control? I actually have an argument for why we should expect human brain software to last a lot longer than many think. So many people make this argument that you say, well, look, the human brain, the software in the human brain, it was evolved a long time ago. Evolution did it. Evolution is not really very clever. Evolution didn't make this very modular. It was designed for this old world that we're no longer in. It's hard to modify. It's not very well designed. It's for optimized for some old world. Clearly, it's just going to lose. Okay, that's the kind of argument saying that this thing just can't last. Come on. But I want to make the analogy to multicellular animals. So if you think about single-celled animals or plants, organisms, they evolved for billions of years. And this little package of a cell became really well honed as a package. All these little parts became really well integrated, and there was a limitation on the size, and so mostly in order to add more features or capability, you had to just figure out how to organize this thing a little better. You couldn't just add things on anytime you wanted something. And then when it finally became possible to make a much larger organism, you might have thought we would just go back to scratch and design a much larger thing with much larger parts inside that could take advantage of scale economies, et cetera. But instead, what evolution did is it took all these little cells and pasted them together, which, if you think about it, is remarkably wasteful. Each one of these cells has most of the things you need to survive out in the wild, but now it doesn't need to survive in the wild. It's part of this big package. And most of the parts of the cell aren't, they don't scale very well. Yeah. You could imagine getting much more productivity and effectiveness by having like much larger units, but instead you take all these little tiny units and you just paste them together. And so that's an analogy to the brain, because you might have thought, well, shouldn't these small cells have just been outcompeted by some larger organism that was just reorganized internally?
Yeah.
And the counter argument is to say, well, when you spend all that time honing this package so well, it's expensive to try to start over from scratch in design, and that might not be worth bothering. You might just rather take a unit that works and that works well and just paste them together. So analogous argument for the brain is, hey, this brain is this really well worked out package. So the brain went through this long period of evolution where, because hardware and software weren't separated, in order to add a new functionality, you had to add new hardware. You had to add new brain tissue. And that's really expensive. So it couldn't really add very much new stuff. It mostly could reorganize old stuff. And so it became this really well-organized package of stuff that's not very modular, but still very highly tuned. And now you might think, well, that's just a really handy package. Now, of course, it doesn't win everywhere. Clearly, we already have software that beats humans, ordinary humans, at stuff we do. But you could still imagine that could last a long time. There could be, that package could be a handy feature. Now, you know, the cells that are inside your body aren't quite the same as a cell that's outside wandering by itself. Some modifications have been made, but they've mostly been the easy modifications. You know, the more you get into the mix, the messy mix of things that are hard to change, the more you mostly leave it alone. And so even with brains, we'll be able to change some things in the brains, but they will be interface changes. So if you think about it, in general, in systems, interfaces last longer than internals. Interfaces are harder to change because more things depend on them. So if the brain has many different parts, the interfaces between the parts will probably last longer than the inside of each. and the interface between each brain and other brains will probably last longer. So today, many, and in the future, many jobs, and with EMS, many jobs are assuming that something like a human is sitting in that slot. And so you make many other assumptions about how the job is designed and how other supporting resources and tools are designed in order to match that assumption. Mm-hmm. And so even if eventually later you end up being able to change how that thing's implemented, you'll be less willing to change the interface because that's something many things have assumed. So you might still have things that on the outside look like humans and interact with each other as if they were humans. Mm-hmm. Even if internally their organization and design has changed substantially, mm-hmm. Because that was, you know, entrenched as a feature of the system. And so you have this vision of human-like things lasting a long time in a competitive world where they're winning in competition. It's not like somebody had to tip the tables to like help them out against the other competition.
I love that. That's really fascinating. What you were just saying about the interfaces makes me think about I think Google's Duplex thing that they just demoed.
Right.
And someone said, we wondered what the computer to computer interface was going to be. And now we've found it, that it's actually computers imitating humans saying, and things like that to each other on the phone, that's the future right. We're looking at.
I mean, that makes sense. So there's something called Conway's Law in software design, which says that when software has a modularity structure, that is, it has a section of modules that are connected to each other, less between the modules than within each other, that structure tends to reflect the structure of the organization that wrote the software. Mm-hmm. Which makes sense, except you realize another competing source for the structure of the software might be the problem you were solving. Mm-hmm. But it turns out the structure of the organization wins out over the problem you're solving. Mm-hmm. Because the organizations really want to maintain that structure in how they build the software.
Yeah.
So that means as we create software over time, that software may well also reflect the structure of the organizations that made it for a long time. There could be this big inertia effect whereby familiar structures of firms and jobs and tasks and industries and cities, that familiar structure could last a long time into a world where all the little parts are now replaced by other things.
Mm-hmm. So when you first said that, like the idea of like gluing brains together and so forth, I was thinking of something like the Borg, but what you're actually talking about might be more like political and social structures.
Something like the familiar structures could last, exactly. Hmm. The familiar structures of firms that we have and churches and you know, cities, et cetera. Those structures of who has which tasks and which responsibility and who's supposed to report to who and who can see what. All those complicated structures could last a lot longer than you might think. They are not necessarily just there because people are there. They are a structure, and structures last.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. It's interesting to think of, because what this points to me is the idea of like a superintelligence, which is essentially a society like you're talking about, right?
Well, of course, our society is a superintelligence. I mean, quite literally. We are 7 billion people who are clearly much more capable and smarter than any one of us. And you know, you might ask, well, if you say I'm imagining a different kind of superintelligence, then we might ask you, well, what do you have in mind? And so, you know, but we do, most organizations are superintelligence. Walmart is a superintelligence. Google is a superintelligence, clearly. By many or obvious ordinary definitions. And so we're already in a world with superintelligences. If you thought that had problems, then they're right there. Yeah. And so you'll have to redefine what you meant by, I meant another's particular kind of superintelligence, which is fine. But we've already passed, you know, crossed that bridge.
Yeah. So looking out at this kind of future and how long these kinds of organizations and our brain structures and so forth might last, we run into a big question, which you have talked about quite a bit, which is the great filter, right? So can we anticipate that we have a long future, or can we not? What's the likelihood?
So the great filter is a important argument. But it's weak and it has limits. Basically, it says when you look out in the night sky and everything looks dark, then you have to conclude that nowhere else in your visible universe has life started simple and small and then grown to become an expanding civilization. Mm-hmm. And that means the thing that you hope to do to become this expanding visible civilization, it could be a lot harder than you think. Mm-hmm. You don't know where it's harder, but it's clearly hard. Mm-hmm. And so now it might be that the difficulty is past you, in your past. And that means it, there is no consequence about your future difficulty. You've somehow lucked out and got past the filter, and now there is no future filter to face, or not much of one to be worried about. Just but the fact that the filters are so huge means you can't be entirely sure of that. Mm-hmm. And you should worry a bit that the future filter might well be ahead of you, because your evidence for it being in the past is weak. Mm-hmm. So all it really says is to watch out for things that could kill everybody, because that should be a bit more likely than you might have thought, mm-hmm. had you not considered this issue. Mm-hmm. And so worry about it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't tell you which particular scenarios to worry about.
Right.
But one scenario we can clearly know not to worry about is scenarios where something takes over and replaces us, mm-hmm. and then goes on to become visible in the universe. Mm-hmm. The Great Filter is not at all predicting those. Those would not explain the Great Filter. Mm-hmm. So those may be things to worry about, but they are not things to worry about extra, mm-hmm. Because of the Great Filter, because they wouldn't explain it. Yeah. Things that would kill you and your descendants off such that they don't go out and expand, those are the things to worry about.
Yeah, so the Great Filter is basically, I think in one of your talks, you talked about looking a billion years in the past, something like that, scanning. We don't see anything. So we know that that in 12 billion years or so, nothing has risen to this level. Nothing has, I think in your words, gone from dead matter to expanding, lasting life, right? Something like that. So you're saying, so this is interesting though, because we don't have to worry about robots taking over or even like aliens taking over or dolphins taking over or something like that. We don't have to worry about many of those scenarios. The scenario to worry about is, in fact, does just life just stop entirely? You're saying though, you don't seem very worried about that at the moment. So what's the lack of concern there, given that the universe is dark?
The most likely hypothesis is that the very beginning of life was just really, really hard. Mm-hmm. The simplest life we know about still looks to me enormously complicated, mm-hmm. amazingly complicated. In fact, I think it's more likely than not that life came from elsewhere outside of Earth, just because the very first life on Earth still looks ridiculously complicated. And say Mars was ready for life before Earth was, and life can seem to relatively easily move from Mars to Earth. So it would make sense that, say, life was on Mars before it was on Earth, and maybe it was somewhere else nearby even before that. And so it just seems to have been really hard to get started. So that's an assumption, a scenario that fits and is fine. It's just I can't be sure of it.
Right. Yeah.
It's the not being sure of it that makes me worry.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
If I could be sure of that, then it would be done. And of course, if we ever find life out there in the universe that doesn't look like it was on the same causal path as the life that led to us, now we have to worry a lot more, because mm-hmm. that would just shut down that explanation that the beginning is so ridiculously unlikely.
So
if it isn't a close sibling in our past, then that would really be then you should worry a lot more.
Yeah, that's actually, so I've tended to think that the primary filter was like the beginning of life itself, because it does seem like such a huge leap. But that goes to my pre-existing biases with like the Christian narrative and so forth, right? That there is this incredible leap from nothingness to somethingness, right? But we don't have a better scenario other than what you're talking about, life coming from somewhere else, maybe that it developed. So that does seem to be a compelling possibility.
Well, as you're in some sense pointing out, the whole analysis here assumes that the universe isn't already taken over by a vast power. Okay.
Yeah.
You could say, well, yes, the universe looks dead, but that's misleading.
Yeah.
There's a powerful life behind all of it, and it's chosen for some reason to make this universe look dead. And so, you know, that assumption sort of negates the whole rest of the analysis that says, okay, you know, now, you know, then the question is, well, how can we judge these hypotheses or scenarios where there really is a vast power out there that wanted to make it all look dead? Because that's a harder space of scenarios to to analyze, right? And of course, you know, you want to go back from that scenario where say, okay, where did this power come from? How early did it arise? Did it start at the very beginning of the universe, or did it evolve at the beginning? You know, so if it had to evolve, now you need a scenario where it arose early and then spread out and then stopped everything else from replacing it, right? Or from competing with it. So it has to be this somewhat, however nice it is now, it had to be kind of ruthless early on because it went out and like prevented everything else from being like it. And so you could tell stories of the great power that arose early and made sure to, you know, merge with or prevent all the other things that compete with it. And then it had some agenda by which it wanted everything to continue to look dead.
Well, yeah, that's...
except us, of course. Except it wanted us not to look dead. You know, and that's logically possible. You know, when I look at that and I go, well, I just don't have much of a good reason to buy this scenario. I mean, yes, I agree it's consistent with the evidence, but I'm not, you're not giving me much of an a priori reason to find this a plausible hypothesis other than, yes, you could tell a story how it's, we can't disprove it.
So it reminds me, though, of because that in some sense is both the theistic scenario and also the creepiest scenario, right? There XKCD I think did a thing on it where it's like, you know, if everything looks like it's just the background, then maybe it's because they're all hiding from a predator, right? And so
well, the berserker scenario, I guess I've called it, which is a different, it's somewhat different scenario. So that says there is no single power out there ruling everything. There's just a bunch of separate powers all hiding from each other. And so on the surface, that sounds plausible. And on the surface, that would explain why everything looks dead. When I've tried to analyze it, it just doesn't work. I'm sorry. Thinking that one through, it just doesn't make sense. There could be a time over which that scenario would play out, but it wouldn't last that long. Eventually, some side would jump up and take over and win. At which point we wouldn't, everything wouldn't look dead anymore. It's a thing that could only explain a limited space-time volume of things looking dead. I just don't buy it as a larger explanation, but it's at least the sort of thing that that was worth thinking through before I drew that conclusion. It wasn't, but I just can't believe it.
The other thing that people have proposed is the transcension hypothesis, I think, which is essentially that civilizations collapse in on themselves, not in a negative way, but basically become entirely internally focused and basically shrink from the visible universe. Have you given any thought to that?
Well, sure. I mean, the key puzzle is why it doesn't leave any tail of things going elsewhere. So, you know, people certainly have moved in many ways. People have moved from one physical place to another. They move from one profession to another. They move from one firm or industry to another. But they've almost always left other people behind. They haven't all moved. And so any attractive destination can be an explanation why there might be some flow in that direction. But you need a much more powerful explanation why in a diverse world with lots of variation, nothing ever takes any other path. Nothing ever goes anywhere else. So we see this vast universe and there's clearly places to go there. There might be this other place that's more attractive, but how, why is it that nobody else goes anywhere but this other more attractive place? That's the hard thing to believe.
So the universe is mysterious no matter which which way we slice it. I think you've dealt with this a little bit. What's your take on the simulation argument? I think you wrote something, How to Live in a Simulation. So
I did. People aren't, so that's, it's interesting to me to notice that. That is, when the topic first, you know, became more prominent, where people were talking about it, I mean, I've been talked more privately before, people really focus on, is it true and is it plausible? But they have very little interest in talking about what would happen, what should I do if? So that's related to the emulation scenario in the sense people are really focused on, could emulations happen and would they be philosophically correct, et cetera, but they aren't very interested in what would happen as a result. So similarly, I wrote this essay on how to live in a simulation. simulation if it's true, and how that should affect your behavior. And there's been almost no interest in that. It suggests that people are mainly in this cosmological mode of wanting to talk cosmology, and they're not actually in a practical mode of how should I live my life, mm-hmm. Even if they claim to take the argument seriously, mm-hmm. which is an interesting, you know, data point on how we treat these topics.
Yeah.
But basically my, so the key idea here is to say that an expanding future, a capable future, some fraction of that future will be interested in its past. Mm-hmm. One of the ways for a capable future to pay attention to the past is to create a simulation of its past. In the simulation, there could be creatures like you and I, mm-hmm. who in the simulation don't know they're in the that they are mm-hmm. a simulation of the past. They think they're actually in the past, but they're not actually in the past. They're a future simulation of the past. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now the question is, well, how many such creatures should we expect, people who are not in the past but think they're in the past, compared to the actual people in the past? So it's a ratios thing. Mm-hmm. So the simulation argument, in order for you to conclude that you are probably in this future simulation, you need to believe that there are a lot more creatures who think they're in the past but aren't really than are actually in the past. Mm-hmm. Now, this basically comes down to the rate, not only the rate at which the future economy grows and how big it gets, but the rate at which people's interest in the past declines with how far past it is. Hmm. Okay. So if people maintain a large interest in the past, and their large interest was encompassing most of the past, then the simulation argument becomes more plausible. That is, this future is vast, and even a small fraction of it could be larger than the past. Mm-hmm. That is, if say the you know, at some point in the future, say the future is a billion times more capable than we are, with a billion times more creatures. Well, mm-hmm. if it spends one billionth of its resource emulating the past, well, that there might be more creatures emulate, you know, as many creatures of the past emulated as there are people in the past. Mm-hmm. So the key question is the rate at which the economy goes relative to the rate at which we get less interested in the past.
Yeah.
And so you can then say, well, we can now look at our past. We can say, well, how quickly does our interest in the past diminish? Mm-hmm. as it gets farther into the past. Mm-hmm. So during, say, the farming era, the economy doubled roughly every 1,000 years. And so you might ask, well, does our interest in previous civilizations go down by half every 1,000 years, or more than half or less than half every 1,000 years? Mm-hmm. And I've got to say it goes down by more than half. Hmm. When I look at people's interest in the past relative to the growth rate, I got to say their interest declines faster mm-hmm. than the relative growth rate we're talking about.
Yeah.
So that means this simulation ratio doesn't win. Mm-hmm. That is, even though the economy comes larger, the rate at which we lose interest in the past is even larger, mm-hmm. grows even faster.
Mm-hmm. So that would apply on average, but what that points out to me is that there would probably be key points that would be much more interesting.
Sure.
So I think of I always, when talking about the simulation argument, I always talk about Oregon Trail, you know, and I was like, if we made a Oregon Trail right. VR, right? So it's plausible that people would be very interested in the Oregon Trail, but not anything like, you know, the year before that opened up and or the right. year after or something like that.
So right. So now we have to ask, you know, what heuristics or indicators could you use that the mm-hmm. world you're in is so unusually interesting
yeah, right.
to the future that it would raise your chance of being in a simulation?
Right.
And of course, for most people, that it won't pass that test, right?
Yeah.
Clearly, on average, for most people doing that right. analysis will not find that their period is so interesting. But clearly, a few people might. So Bill Gates, for example.
Yeah.
He's got to worry.
Yeah. He should assume that he's in a simulation. Right.
I don't know if he should, but he should do more of the calculation. Right?
So that's actually, yeah. So what that actually implies, if I'm thinking through this correctly, is if you try. Or
Donald Trump even. I mean, yeah, Donald right. Trump should probably presume he's in a simulation too, right?
So the presumption should be, if you try and succeed at being more interesting, like, you have increased the odds of yourself being in a simulation. Am I thinking through that right? Like, if you work hard yes. to be interesting.
So my analysis of how to live in a simulation says most simulations are going to be small compared to the world you're in. So mm-hmm. Your simulation is not, you're going to look like you're in a big world, and that big world isn't really there. Mm-hmm. There's a small part of that world that's really there, and the rest of it seems like it's there, but it's not. Mm-hmm. That's both true in space and time. So you shouldn't worry about donating to Africa. You shouldn't worry about saving for retirement. These things don't exist. So you should focus on a much smaller world around you. Mm-hmm. And of course, you should guess about the motives. And if it's trying to make something interesting, you should try to keep the small world interesting. And so on the margin, that will keep it going longer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is a reasonable strategy. For whatever are the plausible motives, somebody might be simulating it. Make sure you stay true to that, right? Mm-hmm. Closer to that. So if they're trying to be historically accurate, don't make it too inaccurate. Mm-hmm. If they're trying to make it interesting, be interesting. Just to make a good story, make it a good story. Whatever it is, you know, those are all things you should, on the margin, try a little bit to do, because that would help.
Yeah.
But again, you know, the main thing is you need some reason to think this is likely to be a story. Now, mm-hmm. of course, you know, a key question is, when people are simulating this past world, how much do they care mm-hmm. if you deviate from what that real past would have been?
Right.
Right. Because every way in which you try to be to try to take into account of the fact that you're in a simulation to change it is deviating a bit from what right. the actual past had been.
Right.
So you have to make some rough guess about how tolerant these people are for those deviations. You'll mm-hmm. want to deviate a little bit to the extent that it makes it a little more interesting. But if you make it too interesting, now it becomes implausibly not the past. Of course, you know, if the real people in the past hadn't actually anticipated they might be in a simulation and would in fact have done things to make it be more interesting, now there's less of a problem.
Right.
You're simulating people who thought they might be in a simulation. They were trying to make sure it would last. And right. that's in fact the world you're trying to simulate.
I like that world better, you know, where we're trying to make everything interesting based on the assumption, and then we can just keep going with that. I like that. Yeah, that's.
But again, I just think for most of us, the vast majority of us, most of the time, it's just less likely. You're more likely in the actual world, and so that's probably what you should go with.
Yeah, that's interesting. The less interesting your times are, the less interesting you are, the more likely you're in your real life, and not in a simulation. Okay. Well, I love it. Well, I would love to keep exploring these things, but I'm gonna call time here. And
it's been great chatting.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll put links to the books. Because I think both of those are great to check out. Anything else? I can put a link to your website. Anything else that people should be looking into?
That's plenty.
Okay. We'll do it. Well, thanks.
It'd be great chatting. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks a lot, man.
Take care.
You too.